Escapes and Escapades. Von Gunter Wilhelm. Prologue. It was during a hospital stay between waiting for diagnoses and examinations, and to conquer boredom that I began to write down a bit about of my life. I soon realized how exciting it was to remember not only the formative phases of my life but also the interesting experiences of youth, the friendships, and work. Furthermore, it became clear to me that my former professional activities were unique, and that the interconnected world in the way I have experienced it has unfortunately become superfluous today. During my 32-year stint at the International Engineering Office, I often had to carry cases full of documents over to other countries and live and work with the people there for a long time. I have a good memory of these trips and have personally benefited from them. For instance, I have become more attentive. These experiences have certainly not affected me negatively, which is partly because of my disregard for religion, belief, apartheid, wealth, poverty, prostitution, alcohol, and lifestyle. With today's information technology, the communication and transfer of knowledge or data is possible in a brief time and practically at the click of a mouse. But real interpersonal relationships and experiences are often missing. The way of living and working in a largely impersonal way with the associated lack of movement leads to more and more diseases. I do have health impairments related to walking and speaking, and have been diagnosed with diseases ranging from Parkinson's to polyneuropathy. The reason, however, may not be my previous occupation. Anyhow, it is not important for me to study their cause. Rather, it is my goal to stabilize myself soon. This is an autobiographical narrative from my memory. All persons, names, actions, places, pictures, and photographs are non-fictitious. Escape from the war. I was born on September 3, 1941 in Zieltendorf, about 130 kilometers southeast of Berlin and 6 km from the River Oder, sometime in the night. My parents have told me that Christbaum could be seen in the sky at that time, probably due to the bombing of Berlin by Soviet bomber aircraft. Escape from the Russians. In April 1945, my parents and I escaped from the Red Army in Zieltendorf to Riesen. I can still remember that during that flight, my mother and I hid in a pile of beetroot in fear of the Russians. Although I was obviously not aware of the atrocities and rapes at my age, I felt the fear at every corner. So, I remember those moments vividly. My mother had my hair carefully trimmed so that I would not get the lice the Russians had brought with them. My father soon had to return to the Volkssturm, to the war front, which ran along the Oder. Any behavior that deviated from the prevailing NS norms was documented in many cases and, unfortunately, led to a rapid death in countless of them. My father was captured by the Russians and put in several internment camps: Sachsenhausen, Oranienburg, Katschendorf, and Buchenwald. The Soviet soldiers in the Soviet occupation zone used the Nazi concentration camps as their internment camps. From what I have heard from my father, these camps had concentration camp-like conditions. Escape to the West. At first, we heard nothing about my father. So, my mother fled with me from Riesen to Lauterbach/Hesse to the Vogelsberg, where my sister Margot worked in the hospital. I do not remember any more how we got there. All I can remember are rides in crowded trains and long walks in the dark. 1948, I was enrolled in Lauterbach/Hessen in the Vogelsberg Montanese. My father was released from the internment camp in 1948. This was somehow reported to us. Therefore, my mother and I then returned to Zieltendorf because my father wanted to go back to his farm. Return to the East. In Zieltendorf, I attended the Volksschule with good success but faced criticism for my social work. I worked intensively with the Protestant church community at that time. The pastor's charge suggested that I attend a priest's seminar, but my parents hesitated. They really needed me to work on the farm. The time in Zieltendorf was depressing. No one could freely express himself/herself. My parents always insisted, "Say nothing at school. If you heard a car at night, you knew it could only be the Stasi, because there were no other cars there." Often, One heard the next day that somebody had been picked up. A behavior that deviated from the prevailing GDR social standards could be very dangerous. I was only 14 when I fell in love for the first time. Karen, my girlfriend, was visiting her relatives in Zehlendorf during her Christmas holidays. She was also 14 and came from Stalinstadt, now Eisenhüttenstadt. There was a certain urban flair in her which attracted the entire male youth in the village very quickly. After many talks on icy cold evenings, she probably narrowed down her choice to two favorites, my friend Harry and I. The three of us met almost every evening until the moment of farewell came. On that day, Harry and I took Karen to the station. The three of us talked and Harry tried to make a verbal impression upon her. I just let him talk and went to the ticket office. I took a ticket to Forstenberg/Oder, which was two stops on the way to Stalinstadt, where Karen was headed. Both Karen and Harry were greatly surprised when I hopped on the train. Once the train was in Forstenberg/Oder, we started looking for a place to avoid the cold and the snow. Finally, we found an empty bus station. We hugged each other intently and kissed without shyness, again and again. We were very happy, though it was only a little innocent embracing and kissing. Karen said there was a more devilish way of kissing, and though neither of us knew the word sex or its meaning, we were both at the height of our feelings. I never forgot this moment. Unfortunately, Karen had to leave with her parents the next day, and I never saw her again. Work and leisure in the East. My father soon insisted that I should take over a part of his farm. I also started teaching as a plant farmer and soon visited the Berufsschule Martin Andersen Nexo in Forstenberg/Oder. I did not want to go to FDJ. Instead, I became a member of the Society for Sports and Technology, GST, the motorsport group that organized shooting exercises. I got the GST driving license at the age of 15. The traffic people's police used to hold the driving test in the GDR then. Our test was taken by Teichmann, a much feared traffic policeman. However, the test turned out to be quite short and simple for me, thanks to an incident with a cyclist. As the group leader, I drove the truck from Forstenberg towards Oder Spree Canal with the other examines in the back. On a bridge over the canal, I drove up close to an elderly cyclist. But she did not hear our vehicle approaching. Suddenly, when I was about to overtake her, she tried to turn left, onto a dirt road next to the canal. Since even a full brake could not have prevented a crash, I honked instinctively. Thankfully, the woman veered to the right at once. Teichmann immediately ordered me to stop. He put on his white traffic policeman's hat and got out. I heard him yell at the woman. Then he came back and told me, "Get out." Test passed. However, I could drive only GST vehicles and also tractors because the situation of agriculture in GDR was very tense. Hence, I worked both in my parental company and as a tractor driver at the Machine Tractor Station, MTS, in the Ernst Thalmann settlement. Republikflucht. After compulsory collectivization of the farm and selling off the horses, my parents and I decided to escape to West Berlin through the Federal Republic. For security reasons and to avoid any interrogation, we told neither my best friend Harry nor our relatives and friends about our escape plan. The only exceptions were our harvest helper Frau and Mr. Menz in Forstenberg/Oder. On May 15, 1960, I went to the Menz's in Forstenberg early in the morning. Traveling directly from the small train station in Zehlendorf would have been too dangerous because of the strict watch of the Stasi. As a companion of Mr. Menz, who had permission for medical treatment at the St. Hedwig Hospital in West Berlin, we took the train to Erner. The first check was amazingly smooth. Then, we arrived in Friedrichstrasse, which was the last S-Bahn station in the former East Berlin. I knew the way very well from earlier trips as a child and was prepared to flee on foot. For some reason, the control of the People's Police seemed to be extremely hasty on that day. The Vapas took a brief glance at the letter. The S-Bahn went on, and suddenly, I was in West Berlin. It had been so arranged that I would stay with a friend in West Berlin and my parents would not meet me until the next day. But my parents did not turn up on the S-Bahn at the appointed time. I was nearly about to take a train back to the east to look for them. But our friend advised me to stay. So, we waited a few more trains, and finally, there they were. My parents told us what had happened. They were taken out of the train at Friedrichstrasse station and interrogated separately. Both probably thought that their fate was sealed and that they would face the Republic's fury. But surprisingly, they were dismissed. So, I believe that decent people were present even among the controllers of the GDR. After we were all safely in West Berlin, we first reported to Marienfelde. We were interrogated by various secret services, especially the Americans. During this time, I also held general talks with a gentleman who had been spying on the West in the East, and was not satisfied with his situation at all. On the other hand, I was very satisfied and very anxious about the future. I had great plans. After the registration in Gießen, we immediately came to Langenzelbold. Finally, I landed in the Bullenkloster at the Odenwaldring in Offenbach am Main. My parents, sister, and brother-in-law also lived in Offenbach am Main, and so, we were a big family for a couple of years. New life in the West. With my sister's reference, I got an apprenticeship as a machine locksmith at Verdenhagen KG in Offenbach. I enjoyed the work and I took it very seriously. I also took evening classes to complete the Fachhochschule Reif, which cleared me for higher education. On a VHS trip to London, I got to know a girl from Buckeberg. She was about 2 years older than I was. Although we soon got close, I cannot remember her name any longer. But I remember that she was very feminine, spoke high German, and was also quite a tête-à-tête for me. She urged me to be with her in her hotel room. For me, the first time, however, was catastrophic. I was just too inexperienced, too stormy, and not at all sensitive. I pushed for a quick and rude penetration, which was certainly not good for her, and it obviously did not satisfy her. We lay in bed for a while, next to each other. I believe we did not speak much. But she suddenly began to massage me in the intimate area. I was so irritated, insecure, and embarrassed that I felt even worse. It was simply not the way you would want it the first time. After the apprenticeship, I worked for another year in Verdenhagen to earn money for an engineering course. I started taking the entrance examinations of the engineering schools at Friedberg/Hesse and Frankfurt AM. I had no luck in Friedberg. But in Frankfurt, I found more success. I bagged a seat in the newly established branch of the engineering school in Rüsselsheim. So, I went by train every day from Offenbach/Main via Frankfurt/Main to Rüsselsheim. In Frankfurt/South, my friends Rosenkrantz and Martin would board the train. We would discuss the upcoming tasks during the train journey. Martin was very introverted, and though he always knew everything about the train, he failed almost every exam. All mechanical engineering students were freed from military service at that time because there was a shortage of engineers. I did quite well in the engineering examination to earn the Ing. Grad degree, though some people scoffed at that time at the protected designation. Because of the first economic crisis at the time, I initially found no job. So, my friend Peter and I decided to make use of an offer from the State Engineering College Saarbrücken to complete a semester on nuclear technology and radiation protection. In Saarbrücken, I rented an attic. I went every day from Schenkelberg on the other side of the city to the engineering school in Saarbrücken. I liked the atmosphere in Saarbrücken. Things were much more relaxed than before in Offenbach. Although we had very little money, Peter and I started going out more often, and even for a beer once in a while at the most well-known Saarlandrestaurant St. We would often meet some girl or the other. Peter quite quickly got into a fried potato ratio with a girl called Brunhild. But I avoided making any firm attachment. Instead, I once spoke to a plump young girl at the St. Johanna Market. She promptly took me to her room. I was inexperienced and had not asked about her price, which I regretted later. She tried to get as much money out of my pocket as possible. She prided herself on her figure. Probably because I was still too young, she thought she should take advantage of her tight breasts. Although my small financial resources were spent very quickly, she put a condom on me with practiced hands and lay seductively on the bed. The bed creaked terribly, which bothered me no end. Nevertheless, I came to the desired climax after a few minutes. I was happy that I was in such good shape and wanted to feel it right again. But in the second round, it seemed to take too long. Instead, she suggested that she would spoil me with her hands, which I foolishly allowed. When she realized that it worked and would probably work again, she ended it abruptly. Instead, she brought a girlfriend into the room. The two clever women probably realized very quickly that I wanted more and was in such a situation for the first time. So, they asked me to spit on them. It was supposed to bring luck. Later, it occurred to me that I could have expected a consideration from the two for the spit in anticipation of the many moments of luck and financial opportunity they would enjoy. So, I had probably once again missed a chance. However, I did not spend my time only on such frivolous pleasures. I spent the nights in my attic studying intensely to pass the final examination on nuclear technology and radiation protection. Especially, Dr. Hausler of the State Engineering School Saarbrücken held very informative as well as informal lectures, both in the classroom and sometimes in Café Ludwig or even at the swimming pool Totobad. We were only 8 students. Often, he showed us interesting things from Saarbrücken, and sometimes arranged excursions to sites steeped in history, for example, the Spiekeroerhöhe. An internship at the Karlsruhe Core Research Center, including the reactor, under the direction of someone we called Arthur, the heatable, was part of the semester. Arthur, who obviously came from Saxony, let us play all the reactor conditions, right up to the emergency shutdown. The response was fast reaction and fingertip sensation. After passing the examination in nuclear technology and radiation protection, I bagged a scholarship from the Federal Ministry of Research under Minister Stoltenberg. But I wanted to enjoy Saarbrücken for a few more days. Marital bliss with Vera. I saw Vera for the first time when I went for a swim in the Totobad along with Peter. She was having some problems with her radio. Since I liked her resolute style, her figure, and the powerful thighs in the bathing suit, I offered to help. I could somehow set the radio in motion. Vera, Peter, and I left the Totobad together and arranged to have ice cream the next day. The next day, both Vera and I reached the ice cream parlor a bit earlier than scheduled. We then decided to go for a walk in the German-French garden. After we had first talked about the broad public ways, we suddenly found ourselves alone on a narrow path in the bushes. I had a great desire to kiss Vera. It was a very hard and intense kiss. We kissed each other persistently and then took a taxi to my place. We kissed almost continuously in the taxi. When we were finally in my room, we quickly took off whatever we had on us and got into bed. Vera was then almost 16. But the union was wonderful and both of us felt good about it. Since July 1967, we remained in touch and visited each other regularly at the beginning of the month and, later, every week. Finally, we got married on May 28, 1971. Even today, I find Vera very desirable. After a few days, I returned to Offenbach and wrote many applications. Because of Vera, I now also applied to companies in Saarland, but with no luck. Finally, the company Newcomb in Hanau/Wolfgang hired me as an engineer, probably because of my additional nuclear engineering degree. At first, I designed remote samplers for the research department, and then, uranium mixers, so-called flounders, in which it was important for the uranium to be mixed without the critical mass that would otherwise lead to a chain reaction. Finally, I became the coordinator between the Newcomb and the Ullmann Construction Office in Hanau. After about a year of working at the Newcomb, I joined Ullman for a higher salary and started working at the company Lurgy in Frankfurt am. Lurgy was a globally active engineering company in the metal industry. But at that time, it was well known only among insiders. I initially worked as an external constructor in the design office. When Ullman could no longer pay my salary, I became a Lurgian. I was greatly dependent on the salary because Vera and I had moved into an apartment in Steinbach am Taunus immediately after our marriage in May 1971. Vera brought the kitchen into the house, and we bought the bed together in Saarbrücken. There was no other furniture, or even curtains. From acquaintances, we got an old carpet and an old garden chair for the living room. But we felt good, and often went hiking in the Taunus. We also visited my parents in Offenbach and Vera's mother in Saarbrücken regularly in our old VW Beetle. With our first Christmas money, we proudly bought a TV set. Our finances started to improve when Vera found work as a chief secretary. She was a lawyer's secretary, in the legal department of the Lurgy for Dr. Ebert. We could finally furnish our living room. When our son Dirk was born in January 1977, we could set up the children's room and were very happy about it. However, there were many uneasy nights, which were particularly hard for Vera. Travel to Brazil. In April 1977, I went on my first mission to Brazil, with two suitcases full of drawings and calculations. A colleague and I flew first class with the Varig via Rio de Janeiro to Sao Paulo to our customer CMM, Companhia Minera de Metais, which had paid for our flight. My neighbor on the flight was the Belgian cultural attaché. We got into a conversation. He was a lot on the road, he said, very experienced, and gave me some helpful tips. He advised me to drink champagne during the flight and take a vodka only for caviar. We had a very pleasant flight to Rio de Janeiro, where we had an intermediate landing. However, the landing in Sao Paulo was a little uncomfortable for me because of the short runway. The Sao Paulo airport is in the middle of the city, which is probably why only domestic airlines were allowed to land there at that time. The customer paid for our accommodation in the Hotel Normandy, which was luxurious. We could order food and drinks as we wished. The room furnishings and the quality of the drinks and food were excellent. Our task was to assess the progress of construction of a planned reduction plant in Vazant. We discussed our tasks at the CMM office in Sao Paulo. Dr. Oke, who worked for CMM as a consultant in the pedestrian zone, had probably observed that the food and wine was very good. Since he spoke almost only French, I was surprised when he addressed me in English. He told me on the way to office that at a meeting, our chief executive had only played with the food and hardly touched anything. Obviously, this was negatively registered in the minds of our Brazilian hosts. Thus, in our case, a kind of trust was formed. Furthermore, Dr. Oke want us to extend the estimated completion date of the investment by 6 months in our report. Since the advance was not very realistic, he wanted to ensure that the plant would be finished in a timely manner. Brazilian workers work a lot and well, but not very fast. From Sao Paulo, we first flew to Brasilia with a line engine. From there, we went by air taxis to Cristalina to the construction site in Vazant. Our task was to assess the progress of construction and write a report on it. So, we got up very early with everyone else. There was always a fight for the only available shower. Afterwards, we were served breakfast together in the large entrance hall. Then, we visited the plant and took notes for our report. It was already a special feeling to be in the industrial plant we had planned on the drawing board. At the Frankfurt office, I had designed the exhaust side, and now, I had climbed to the dizzy heights of the cooling tower. But then I noticed that the riffle plate of the stage had not been fixed yet, but only loosely suspended. I became extremely careful then. At the construction site, I lived in the CMM guest house with our director Heinrich Braunig and colleague Valenta. We worked daily from very early morning until late into the night. Only on May 1, 1977, Heinrich said we should treat ourselves. He drove us in his Beetle, with Fernando playing on the auto radio, down uncontaminated paths to the valley of the palm trees, where, besides a lot of palm trees, one could also see many decrepit huts with terrifyingly impoverished inhabitants. After giving our reports, Heinrich said we should throw a farewell party for the Brazilian management staff and their wives because Brazilians like to celebrate. However, he urged us to keep our distance from the women. We learned that Brazilian husbands can be extremely jealous. We were already having many misunderstandings in our conversations due to the language barrier. On the other hand, these Brazilian businessmen liked to go to clubs where they could talk about business and other things. There are all kinds of drinks and plenty of girls. I was approached in a club by the boss, but I excused myself on the pretext that I could not speak Portuguese. At the very next meeting, there was a girl who spoke just as bumpy English as I did. She wanted to stay with me in the hotel. But as a young husband and proud father, I was not interested. On the following day, we discussed the construction progress report. The next evening, we met several company representatives at the club. The informal atmosphere was very useful. Here, some problems regarding capacities, risks, and prices were first discussed unofficially, and, on this basis, in the upper floors later. It was so easy at the club that women felt comfortable. They enjoyed the pleasant atmosphere and tried to satisfy the businessmen as much as possible in a decent manner. For Brazilian conditions, there was already some luxury. During a conversation with my colleague Valenta, a girl sat on my lap so that I could clearly feel her hip holder. She indicated her wish with obvious signs. I defused the situation by patting her vigorously on her thigh. But since she did not understand German, she quickly moved away. However, the next evening, another girl spoke to me in English with more desires. She also wanted to go to the hotel. Apart from the morality aspect, if I'd let myself go, it would have been a costly and risky affair. As a first step, the hotel porter would have to be bribed. The Brazilian law at the time, or even now, said that a foreigner could not leave the country if a Brazilian woman could convince the authorities that she was made pregnant by the foreigner. The foreigner could leave only if the paternity issue was resolved. And that could take a long time. I really did not want the women in the club. Probably they did not even know the law, but just wanted to experience something different and break out of their everyday life for a while. When we were returning to the hotel from the club one night, an indigenous middle-aged woman stood in our way. She begged us to sleep with her. She probably had no food and/or money. In her speechless despair, and to make her desire more intelligible, she suddenly pulled down my colleague's trousers in the middle of the street. Although we quickly moved away, we felt sorry for her. This experience made me think. Brazil had prostitution at every step. For example, young girls and women sold pornography sitting in the gutter beside a pile of sugarcane, with a child in their arms. On behalf of our customer, the CMM, we were proud not only to represent the capital Brasilia, but also to donate a lot of precious stones from Cristalina, which were then transported from Varig to Frankfurt without any extra baggage charge. Travel to South Africa. The one-sided wealth, widespread poverty, crime, and the Brazilian bush colored my imagination on the first flight to South Africa. For flights to our customers, it was customary, at least for the onward flight, to use the domestic airline. So, I flew with South African Airways, SAA, more often. Although the flight was about 3 hours longer compared to, for example, Lufthansa, during the apartheid time, I flew with SAA. It was not allowed to fly over Africa because of the boycott. That is why we flew across Spain, the Canaries to the west along the African continent, sometimes with an intermediate landing on the Portuguese Cape Verde. SAA flew into the African airspace for the first time in South Africa, today's Namibia. I happened to be on the first non-stop flight from Frankfurt to Johannesburg. However, we had to wait another hour because of damage to an aircraft at Cape Verde. On the flights, I always enjoyed the South African red wine. The fact that the plane was escorted by an armored vehicle in Johannesburg initially seemed unusual for me. But I became accustomed to such security measures over time. I had two passports because of the boycotts on South Africa at that time, and had to take care that I always took the right one. I imagined Africa to be somehow very dangerous. So, I was pleasantly surprised by Johannesburg at first. I felt safe on the streets. In my curiosity and lightheartedness, I even looked at the black station once at night. I was probably the only white there, and the blacks looked at me curiously, but by no means threateningly. I was welcomed to the office and introduced to all the important people. Since I wanted to complete my tasks on time, I wanted to start work as soon as possible. The rest of the white staff did not turn up so early, so, they immediately gave me the keys to the office. The next morning, I found all the colored workers in front of the locked office. Although they had been there for many years, they had access only in the presence of a white man. Since I greeted everyone in the office evenly, I was probably a favorite of the colored workers and they treated me preferentially. This had advantages because I could be sure of the fast completion of simple work, like copying, filing, cleaning, making coffee or tea, and the like. Generally, only the colored co-workers did the simple sorting. This made the work of the whites much easier. But in the office and also on the streets, the colored people were badly treated and often harassed by the whites. For instance, I happened to be on the street when a white man elbowed a black man aside just because the latter had not been prompt enough to leave space for him to pass. It was important for us to know as closely as possible the progress and the nature of the work of our competitors Krupp and Davy during our project work. We made a lot of effort. For example, we invited the representatives of local suppliers to eat at a restaurant that served up without. In the somewhat erotic atmosphere, we often heard about the work of our competitors. In addition, we were looking for festivals in Hillbrow, where our competing friends enjoyed a beer or two. Almost everyone lived in the Hotel Statesman in Hillbrow. This was a safe area in Johannesburg. I especially remember a Saturday evening with our competitors in a hotel at the Hartbeespoort Dam outside Johannesburg. At first, I was the passenger of Anne and Norbert. Since I was not a scat player, I drove children and women in the afternoon. The men played scat in a separate hall and drank a lot. In the evening, I would talk to the others at the bar. So, the evening would go by quickly. The first drunken scat players came to the bar and drank with us. Because of the many drunks, the return to Johannesburg seemed impossible one night. And since the hotel was booked, I verbally reserved a sleeping place with the chubby colored woman at the counter. She signaled to me that she still had something suitable. But then it changed suddenly as the first man and the bar stool crashed. I helped her bring her husband into the room. We put him on the bed, took off his shoes and clothes, and then simply covered him. He was so drunk that he did not notice any of this and snored quite unappetizingly. It was not a pleasant sight. The woman was very embarrassed, but she thanked me profusely. When I returned to the bar, I also found our Norbert drunk. He insisted on driving. Only after a long discussion, and I managed to persuade him that he was not supposed to drive. It was bright morning when we arrived in Johannesburg. Norbert slept in the back seat while I drove. We were all dog-tired and I lay down to sleep immediately. In everyday life, it was particularly striking that the colored people were badly treated. They had to do the lowliest of jobs and were harassed. Nevertheless, I liked to work in South Africa because I could concentrate on one project at a time. In the spring of 1983, the issuer was increasingly approaching the SLRN facility ISCOR. For the SLRN plant ISCOR Vanderbijl Park, very elaborate important tables, ISCOR schedules, had to be completed, which would help the customer compare the offer. It was not just about the prices, but also about careful allocation, division, and formulation. That could mean cash and/or customs costs saved. However, this work could only be done with the internally available final figures. Now, things were the same in South Africa as in Germany, the employees wanted to leave punctually in the evening. On the other hand, I always had enough time in the evening and at night. I could then work in peace. But to enter the numbers into the prescribed ISCOR form sheets on the typewriter, I needed help because I was not good at typing. That is why a secretary had to stay longer in the evening. We often worked together in the night. Everything went quite well. She was very clever with the typewriter. So, I could correct the tables quickly. We became a well-established team over time. After work, I would spend the night at the office in Bramfontein, passing the miners' monument between the hospital and the prison to the hotel in Hillbrow. I passed this way almost every morning and every night in the spring of 1983, and it was not dangerous at all. During later stays, however, I could do this no longer due to security reasons. I liked walking a lot because I could compensate for the long hours of sitting in office and thoughtfully prepare the next day's work. I did not accept the offer of the secretary to drive me to the hotel. After submission of the offer with countless surpluses and discounts to ISCOR, my colleague asked me on the customer's site, "Where is the bottle of champagne calculated?" Officially, the order had not yet been published. But because of this subtle hint, I knew that our work had paid off and we would bag the order. In today's financial world, this question from my ISCOR colleague would have been regarded as a prohibited insider tip. After all, it was about an order worth DM 300 million. In this regard, the world has changed a lot, but unfortunately, not in general favor. On a final inspection of the steel works at Highveld Steel, I arrived at the Hotel Statesman on a Friday night and wanted to give my laundry to the hotel manager. I had to fly back to Frankfurt on Sunday. However, since the laundry had closed over the weekend, the porter asked me if I would mind if his wife washed my clothes. Of course, I did not mind. When I got my clean clothes the next day, I realized that it was an honor for the black couple to wash the laundry of a white man. The safety in Johannesburg, however, was deceptive because I heard of several bombings from the ANC, African National Congress, at the Carlton Shopping Center. When I finished my work and it was Friday, my colleague Brunner offered to drive me 70 kilometers away to the ISCOR in Vanderbijl Park, where our steel plant was located. On the way, I suggested that we go to Soweto as well. But Brunner ruled this out very decisively because of the danger of alcoholic Soweto residents, especially on weekends. In front of the gates of ISCOR Vanderbijl Park was a huge car chute. Tough-looking men inspected every car and its trunk very thoroughly. I was about to give up, but Brunner drove all the way to the front. For the checker, it was enough that I was a lurgy worker. Both our company and Germans were very popular at that time. So, we could drive uncontrolled into the factory, though the constant attacks and bombings of the ANC made strict controls necessary. I could see in reality what we had planned. During the stay, I had the feeling of a certain degree of stability in society and the economy in South Africa. At that time, many African countries supplied corn and other foodstuff. A timely and sensible departure from the despicable apartheid would have saved the beautiful country many sacrifices. As a souvenir of my first stay in South Africa, I brought my wife an ostrich egg painted with hunting motifs. It found a place in a closet in our living room and received much admiration, especially from the neighborhood women and acquaintances. Since I had good contact with the company Bushcraft Trading in Johannesburg, I got blank ostrich eggs for many acquaintances. Not only did a limited trade begin to build up, we also took part in Easter markets in our spare time and, therefore, had a lot to do. Since both of us were working, the stress was quite big, especially for my wife. I, however, took this as a hobby rather than a business. On many occasions, I took up contracts with several companies in Africa, India, and Australia during my work-related stays abroad. For example, the Aboriginal people from Perth supplied emu eggs of various sizes. Everything worked reliably and well at the time. Travel to Australia. I stayed in Melbourne, Victoria, Australia for the first time in 1984, for 3 months. The first flight from Frankfurt to Melbourne took quite a long time. The Qantas engine flew first to Rome and then to Bombay, today's Mumbai. All in all, I had been on the plane for more than 30 hours. But the tiredness evaporated quickly, and Melbourne lay at my feet. Colleagues had recommended the inexpensive Hotel Diplomat in St. Kilda. When I asked a young woman for the direction, I noticed a strange smile on her face. But I did not worry about it. At that time, one could still settle for overnight stays and meals. The overnight price of the hotel was so favorable that I saved 50 DM every morning. I always walked through Albert Park to the office. It was a long and beautiful route. But I was not only happy because of the money I saved. In Melbourne, the farther you go from the city, the lower the hotel rates get. I soon became accustomed to living and working there. Already, I was enjoying working on the Anglo-English system in South Africa. I liked the please note, better than the ick tongue. In Australia, however, this got even better. I quickly got used to the life, work, and the left-hand drive in Melbourne. I also learned the hook turn in Melbourne City. If you want to turn right, you must first keep to the left and place the turn signal to the right. Now, let the traffic pass first and, only then, turn to the right. With my Australian colleague Henry, I often spent the lunch break around the lake in Albert Park, which many unemployed people had created during the world economic crisis in the 1930s. Since he was Jewish and escaped from the war in Germany, he wanted to know a lot about the behavior, especially, the Waffen-SS. However, I could not serve him much for reasons of age. Henry had fled Nazi Germany during World War II and then met a Jewish Italian who wanted to go to Australia. They got together. After they had settled in Melbourne and found work, they married. Henry wanted to save his vacation so much that he called in sick at work on the day of his wedding. However, the local press interviewed and photographed them. The next morning, their photograph was splashed in the newspaper along with an article about refugees from Germany with the headline "Australia offers a new homeland to refugees." A very restless Henry went to work. His then boss had the newspaper in his hand. He said, "Henry, the next time you get married, you're going on leave." So, the matter was settled and the two are still hopefully healthy and married. As Henry squeezed out news of Germany from me, I learned from him about the Australian way of life. As we worked together, the communication between us was much easier. We understood each other easily, even without email and Facebook. We always knew quickly what the other meant. I wanted to go to a distinguished restaurant on St. Kilda Road with our then boss Mr. Dorr and colleagues, as well as his business partners. There, our company had a Stammtisch, and an old cognac was always reserved for us. In the district of St. Kilda in Melbourne, I lived in a two-room apartment in an annexe of Hotel Diplomat. Early in the morning, I walked to work and came home tired late at night. On some nights, I was woken by the clip-clops of high-heeled shoes and a baby's shrieks in the apartment above. When I complained at the front desk, I learned that the apartment had been inhabited by a couple from New Zealand. They had vanished without paying. Another thing came to my notice when I met my then Frankfurt CEO Willy Stenger from the airfield. As Lufthansa landed in Melbourne about 3 a.m., I wanted to be on time and drove around midnight by car. I was a little shocked at what was going on in the streets of St. Kilda at night. Women and even men prostituted themselves on the street corners and in certain pubs. I had not even seen this in Brazil or Frankfurt. I could hardly believe it, and was probably quite naive to have lived there for months without noticing it. At that time, my sporty, fair picture of Melbourne took a dent. At the beginning of our project, I had most weekends free. I would often walk around in Melbourne. When I had said this in the office, Rita had suggested that I took a car for the weekend. She was responsible for the vehicle fleet. So, Every Friday night, I got from her not only the keys to a fully refueled car, but also written tips for nice trips. So I got to know the Great Ocean Road. From Geelong and the surrounding area, like Dandenongs and Phillip Island, the Bay of Lorne particularly pleased me. Rita had recommended a restaurant in Lorne from where you could look over the whole bay. It was very dreamlike. I liked it there so much that I started visiting it more often. Since Rita was engaged, I could never invite her for the weekend. So, I often took revenge by having a meal together during work hours. To the discomfort of a few colleagues, we often sat for hours in a restaurant, ate, drank, and got entertained. We liked it, we just found it interesting. There were also many discussions among our colleagues, who often became very personal. Whenever it grew too colorful, I simply stood up and left the room without a word. This worked so well that I became accustomed to it and later used it privately as well as professionally. The project manager Udo Hare, responsible for the Sheoxide project, came to Melbourne from Frankfurt to celebrate his 50th birthday. Our Australia office organized for him a celebration in the rooms of the Liberal Party of Australia, 104 Exhibition Street, Melbourne. This birthday celebration lasted the whole night. It is unforgettable to me because of the lavishness of the whole affair. Even the cutlery was very impressive. The food started with grilled lobster, and was followed by countless small treats. The food lasted for hours. Late at night, we went to Udo's flat and celebrated until early morning. Everyone joined the party and nobody was tired, even though we had drunk a lot. Since I had a car and enough time for the weekend, I made many excursions. I looked at the Great Ocean Road, the very cold Phillip Island with penguins visiting at night, and the jungle-like Dandenongs. However, over the course of time, I was concerned about the date for the completion of our project because my Australian colleagues seemed to be too easy to work with but not adept to give results. I wanted to motivate all the employees who worked on the project within the framework of a common work experience. So, I asked my colleague, Henry Theberger, to send out the invitations. When I came to office the next morning, I found a secretary with a tear-stained face. When I asked her what had happened, she said that she would also work on our project and had not been invited. Henry had simply forgotten about her, and since I once again realized how much importance they gave to being treated similarly, I naturally invited her. Our joint meal lasted the whole afternoon. We talked about both business and our private lives. The work atmosphere had improved so much that I was convinced of the punctual completion of the project. But apart from the date, I still had a calculation problem. The plant offered by our company consisted of a so-called dry part and a wet part. While we were world leaders in the drying section, which mainly consisted of a rotary kiln plant, we simply lacked the know-how for the wet pipe mill, which consisted of large mixing tanks with compressors. That is why an expert from a competitor had been recruited. To avoid legal disputes, all this had to be handled very secretly. So, I was whispered to from above that I would get a commission of $750,000 for this gentleman. Shortly before the official offer was issued, however, I learned from our Australia boss, Mr. Dorr, that our Frankfurt management had signaled to the customer a price of about $40 million. However, my calculation was higher. That is why an employee from Sydney was checking my calculations over the weekend, and everyone believed that a few million would go. However, without informing anyone, I quietly reduced the commission from $750,000 to $57,000. We were then at about $40 million and got the order. I expected to be interrogated about the commission. But, surprisingly, I never needed to justify myself, for everyone seemed to be glad to have received the order. I returned to Frankfurt in September 1984 with a stopover in Hong Kong. The departure from Hong Kong was noteworthy because at the airport, it was pointed out that films were to be transported only in hand luggage. All the films in the check-in luggage would be blackened. At that time, Hong Kong still belonged to Great Britain and there were probably many security measures against China. Nevertheless, I explained to the inspector that the unpacking of my films would be too time-consuming. He smiled briefly and sent the bags through the X-ray tunnel. I thought my photos had been destroyed, but later I found that all of them were still intact. In 1997, when Hong Kong was part of China, I was once again in Melbourne. Before Christmas 1997, the then head of Lurgy Australia, Mr. Dore, handed our offer to customers. Since we thought that the work was done, we organized a Christmas party for all employees. I was relaxed, drunk, and had eaten a lot. I always liked the red wine. I had already booked the return flight with Cathay Pacific for the next day and my bags were already packed. At a late hour, our boss suddenly came back. I was surprised when he told me that the customer needed some changes and that I had to stay. I was drunk, too. My wife had told me earlier that there was water in the basement of our house in Bad Homburg Ober Eschbach. But I seemed to be urgently needed at work. In my drunken state, I cancelled my flight at night by phone, though I was not sure I could get to Frankfurt before the change of the year. In a seemingly emergency situation, I also made the mistake of asking our Frankfurt office for help. But nothing was of any use, I had to press Dongchen in the Melbourne office for a week without having anything to do. The customers had no more change requests. Thanks to the flexibility of Cathay Pacific, I got a flight to Frankfurt before Christmas with an overnight stay in Hong Kong. I went to Australia 5 more times. Next to Melbourne, I stayed thrice in Perth. While in Melbourne, business was more conservative, life in the West Australian Perth was more laid back. On a meal invitation from the company BHP Billiton, I took off my tie quickly because I thought that I was overdressed. A trip to Perth remains a special memory because of the hectic travel preparations. I had forgotten that my German passport had been changed into a European passport in the meantime. In the German passport, I had a permanent visa for Australia, but no visa had yet been entered in the European passport. This I had overlooked in a hurry and I was only aware of it in Singapore when I wanted to switch from Singapore Airlines to the aircraft of the Qantas. Laughing, the Qantas personnel denied me access to the flight to Perth. But I was quickly told that I was near the High Commissioner of Australia in Singapore. They also told me how quickly I would get the necessary visa. The next morning, I queued up at the High Commission. However, the clerk now needed a photo for the visa. So, I had to go to the next automatic close-up machine, have a picture shot, and come back with it without standing in the queue again. In the picture, I could not recognize myself because I was so sweaty. However, I quickly got the visa. With this non-bureaucratic processing, I could still fly with the Qantas to Perth in the evening. Travel to India. After I returned to our headquarters in Frankfurt, I worked on Project Sunflag for India. During my foreign stays, I always had the task of getting in touch with the respective local companies and to get their offers, to compare and, if necessary, do the calculations. So, it was also for the project with our sister company Lurgy India in New Delhi. In October 1984, I arranged a visit on November 3, 1984 with the colleagues in New Delhi. But then, on October 31, 1984, Indira Gandhi was murdered by a Sikh. It was already difficult to communicate with India. But after October 31, 1984, no communication was possible with the Indian colleagues. What should I do? Since all the dates were adjusted in advance, I decided to fly to New Delhi. When my driver drove me to Frankfurt Airport, he asked me as usual, "Well, where are you going this time?" When he heard New Delhi, he was visibly affected. He said, "The boss had his flight ticket cancelled." The boss was our then chief executive Dr. Von Struve. For this Indian project Sunflag, we had to inquire with Indian companies. The communication with India was never easy, but I finally managed to make an arrangement with an Indian colleague Dude. After Indira Gandhi's murder, it was impossible to get in touch with anyone in our office in New Delhi. No one could help me at the Frankfurt office. So much was shown of the assassination on television that my then 7-year-old son started crying. I had to decide. Since everything was already booked, I said nothing. From my previous days abroad, I knew that the events on TV are always shown very drastically. On the spot, it often looks different. With this mindset, I stepped on the flight with Air India. The flight was okay. I met a very nervous dude at the New Delhi airport. The military was everywhere in New Delhi. We passed amazingly quickly through all the roadblocks. I suspect that my European appearance helped. I stayed at the Sheraton Hotel, which is between the airport and the city, and I also heard shots at night. I lived among crew members of different airlines and drove every morning in a taxi slightly downhill to the office in the city center. Porters and taxi drivers saluted and opened the door, which was pleasant but unusual for me. It also happened once that a taxi driver drove into a nearby gas station, asked for advance payment, refilled the fuel tank, and then took me to office. During the day, the work was not particularly difficult because I could concentrate on the essentials with enough helpers available. Lurgy India had also prepared everything well. We talked with representatives of Indian companies, and after a few sentences, one quickly realized who had the necessary knowledge and who did not. The Indian colleagues always gave special emphasis to the fact that I participated in the discussions with our future Sunflag customer. They wanted to demonstrate to the customer the importance of the project. So, I could take it easy. At the end of the evening, we would return to the Sheraton. There you could relax in the swimming pool. The work at our Indian office was, in contrast to the life, activity, and succession in Delhi, well organized. Indian companies sent us more and sometimes less competent representatives. With an Indian colleague, I also had to supply to companies in Pune and Bombay, now Mumbai. With these companies, we also discussed in general the future cooperation between India and the Federal Republic of Germany. The GDR was, at that time, also very much present in India. Our talks lasted longer than planned. That is why we had very little time left to catch the return flight to Delhi. Since we also told our taxi driver about this, the trip to the airport was almost life-threatening. The taxi driver overtook all sorts of things and landed just in front of the oncoming traffic. He did not care whether the vehicles were trucks, cars, or other wagons. In Sao Paulo, I was quite accustomed to this, but this Indian version was a lot more impressive. While I found the moving on Indian roads really hard and almost impossible, because here the right of the stronger always ruled and any hesitation could have devastating consequences, I felt safe in the aeroplanes of Air India. The vegetarian food served was tasty and the takeoffs and landings were okay. The overnight stay in an Indian hotel is a special experience. You sleep on straw bags in very dingy rooms, and use the sanitary facilities only in extreme emergency. The hospitality of Indian companies is, however, very good. I am proud to show you some special sights. I had the opportunity also to make a round trip through New Delhi and Old Delhi and to visit Agra for the world-famous Taj Mahal. But this was precisely in the time of the terrible misfortune of Union Carbide in Bhopal. The chemical catastrophe cost many thousands of Indians their lives. I asked Union Carbide for permission to use the photo below and received the following reply from the USA. I am referring to it in the original, thank you for your information. As you may know, the Bhopal plant is owned, managed, and operated by Union Carbide India Limited, not Union Carbide Corporation. On the last day of my stay in India, I wanted to buy a souvenir for my wife. Together with the Indian colleagues, we came across Indian silk. My friend Tony advised me not to go shopping alone, and offered me his help. So, we both moved through New Delhi and went shopping. Tony spoke and haggled with the salesman. I did not understand a word. At last, we had a few meters of silk fabric for my wife. I wanted to thank him for his efforts and invited him to dinner. As I packed the souvenir in the hotel room, I asked Tony to book a table for us in one of the many restaurants at the Sheraton. Everywhere, however, he received a no. Finally, we went without reservation to one of the restaurants in the Sheraton. And lo and behold, there were still many tables free. We even had the free choice. A little surprised, I talked to Tony about it. After a while, Tony excused himself, saying he had to make a telephone call. I could see the phone on the other side of the dining room quite well. Without hearing anything, I saw Tony gesticulating wildly during his conversation. He came back and we dined together. Then I thanked him again and we said goodbye. I went to my room, put on my swimsuit, and went to the swimming pool. As the Sheraton is between the airport and the city, many flight crew members also put up here. I stayed by the pool until evening. When I returned to my room, I could hardly believe my eyes. On the table stood a large basket of fresh fruit with a business card from the manager saying, "With our best compliments." I was very surprised and thanked them by phone. The reason for the generous gift, however, was not mentioned to me. I suspected later that Tony was denied the reservation because of his Indian dialect and he complained about it. Late in the evening, I took a taxi to the airport. Although the ride was much shorter than the one to the city center, the taxi driver demanded double the price. When I asked him about the reason, he replied only briefly, "International airport." After checking in, I noticed that the Aeroflot to Moscow and the Lufthansa to Frankfurt/Main were handled at the same gate and, suddenly, there were many Germans in the waiting area. I do not know what the difference between East and West Germans is. Was it the clothes, the feeling, the behavior with a cautious choice of words during a conversation? I just do not know. Travel to East Berlin. Back in Frankfurt, I worked on an offer for the Eisenhütten Combinat in Eisenhüttenstadt, the former Stalinstadt, in the GDR. We finished in time before Christmas 1984 and made the dispatch. Cautiously, I sent the folders well packaged as registered mail to the International Trade Center IHZ of the GDR to East Berlin. Then, I spent 3 weeks with my wife and son in Oberdorf. When I was back in the office in the middle of January 1985, I received a call from our former department manager, Dr. Schnabel. He suspected that the offer for the IHZ had still not been completed. Thank God, I could prove with the help of our post office that the offer had already been sent by registered mail before Christmas. In this regard, postal investigations had ended at the then German border. But, we had to make new copies of the offer urgently and I was instructed to hand them over to the IHZ in East Berlin. I was not comfortable to go back to my former republic. But in the end, I received an invitation from the IHZ to hand over of the offer at 11 a.m. one day in the latter half of January 1985 at the IHZ in East Berlin. That day, I took the first Pan Am flight from Frankfurt to West Berlin and then took a taxi to the station zoo. There, I got into the S-Bahn to Friedrichstrasse, exactly the opposite of what I had done on my flight to the west. With the invitation, I could have easily handled all the controls. But I wanted to enter as a normal citizen, to be able to experience the handling procedure. So, I soon found myself in a queue of old people. The old people, mostly retirees, were very rudely treated by the GDR border authorities. That is, a distinction was made between the West Berliners and the citizens of the FRG. Although I have always been a little concerned about border controls, nowhere in the world have I seen such vicious controls as in the GDR. When the controlling borderer became aware that I was in the IHZ, it turned out that here the Stasi had the upper hand, he became more accessible and I could pass quickly. Even with the following trips to East Berlin, I have never experienced a halfway friendly GDR border organ. You only saw petrified faces. On the other hand, I was greeted at the reception and the office of the IHZ in an amazingly pleasant manner. I had to visit an office in a huge building. For this, I received a card with which I could open doors, probably only the ones through which I was allowed to go. Since I was too early, the secretary apologized that her gentlemen were not yet there. I had already been warned by a colleague in Frankfurt. I had no desire to squeeze myself between 20 gentlemen. That's why I said I was very busy and refused the secretary's offer. With the lie that I had to go back to Frankfurt urgently, I left the IHZ as soon as possible. In the Lindenstrasse, I searched in vain for a pub to drink at least one beer. Instead, there were only large shops with books in the shop windows. I tried to make phone calls to my relatives in the GDR from the post in East Berlin. I would have to telephone to the Zehlendorf, which was just under 130 kilometers away, at least 2 hours in advance. So, I bought a wooden toy for my son with the DDR money from the forcible exchange and went again to the narrow Ho Chi Minh path in the direction of Friedrichstrasse to the border crossing, past big signs with the inscription, "Stop, just go on with valid exit documents." Once again, petrified checkers, and then, finally, well-kept ones and, though formerly Republican, but not captured, I was on the S-Bahn platform. Above, in the steel construction of the station, walked entourages and Vapas, Volkspolizisten, patrolled with drawn weapons. As I waited for the S-Bahn, I watched a train come in from West Berlin. After the train came to a stop, shepherds were sent to the train for inspection. At the same time, the Vapas searched all the compartments. East Berlin, the capital of the then GDR, already made a very militaristic impression. There were people in uniforms everywhere, young pioneers, free German youth, people's police, barracked police, volunteers of the people's police, National People's Army, Deutsche Reichsbahn, Society for Sport and Technology, FDGB, and the Russians. Also, the many intrusive posters with slogans of the said determined the cityscape. The wall and the armed border organs blocked the people and acted as a permanently latent threat. No one was safe from spying. Some denounced others to gain their own advantages. That is why people were cautious all the time. It was simply oppressive and humiliating. Most people in the GDR knew nothing else. For them, it was normal. Due to my escape, I had not only had the great fortune of withdrawing myself from it, but thanks to the later professional activity, also the possibility of comparing countries with different social systems. In no other country have I felt so depressed as I did in the GDR, not even in the apartheid of South Africa. In any case, I felt safer in Johannesburg than in East Berlin. But with my own example, I was trying to understand the behavior of the people of the GDR. When I was asked by my employer to return to the GDR, from which I had once fled, for professional reasons, I could have rejected the proposal. I was free to make a decision. A little resentment with my employer would certainly not have cost me my head, not even my job. Nevertheless, I took the risk of being arrested for Republican fights in East Berlin. My motivation was not only the loyalty to the employer but also my own economic situation. Nevertheless, today, I find my behavior at the time irresponsible, and I was lucky to have escaped. For the GDR residents, however, this was fundamentally different. First, they were not free, and second, the GDR state demanded absolute loyalty for the preservation or development of the economic standard, which was already low enough for most people. This explained not only certain behaviors, but the many uniforms, weapons, and party badges. Nevertheless, many of the things cannot be approved today. But there was a change. And most of it will never be done anyway. I was glad then to sit again in the S-Bahn, and to go in the direction of West Berlin. At the station zoo, I got out and tasted a beer in the low-end brow. In November 1985, my colleague Peter Gorlach and I had to go to the IHZ to Ost-Berlin again due to the planned DR plant in Eisenhüttenstadt. I knew very well the area around Eisenhüttenstadt from the time before my escape because my father had owned a partly expropriated forest site there. We had to discuss the plant's planning with the representatives of the heavy machinery building combine Ernst Thalmann, SKET. The SKET people were late because of heavy snowfall. We were asked if we could extend our stay by a day. When I refused and suggested instead to forego the lunch break, the faces of the comrades fell conspicuously. I only realized the reason for this when we accepted an invitation to eat at the Hotel International after finishing the work in the afternoon. The comrades needed us as a pretext to get into the hotel, and suddenly, they became quite different, even though they all had the said party badge intact. The conversation, which was not in line with the state doctrine of the GDR, finally ended with the desire to be invited by us to Frankfurt AM. Although we did so several times, there was never a meeting in the West. In Frankfurt, I had a quiet office with a passageway to that of my older colleague Werner Grund. Werner was very funny, liked to tell jokes, and had good contact with the secretaries. That is why the main entrance was mostly open, and so, we learned very often the latest news from the management level firsthand. Werner was about to retire and did not have ambitious goals of a professional nature. But I enjoyed working and every job was right. I traveled several times to South Africa, Australia, India, France, England, and Finland. I also took part in various cocktail receptions at the Interconti and Frankfurter Hof. Holidays in South Africa. When the new South Africa emerged under Frederick Willem de Klerk, I flew from Frankfurt to Johannesburg with my wife and son at the turn of 1993/1994. I rented a car for a day at the airport. We stayed in a hotel in Bramfontein district. I wanted to show my family the Gold Reef City. However, we first landed in front of a police barrier on the highway. We had to turn around and a policeman directed us to the mine. We were there quite quickly and could look at everything in peace. When we saw the news on TV at the hotel in the evening, we found that the highway had been shut down because of a bomb explosion. On New Year's Eve 1993, we traveled in the Blue Train from Johannesburg to Cape Town. On one of our trips to Cape Town, I had landed accidentally in front of Groote Hospital. I only wanted to ask the way at the entrance, but after a conversation, we were invited to join the rooms of Dr. Christian Barnard, who carried out the first ever heart transplant. New work. Our office was moved from the Frankfurt city center to Heddernheim in the Mertenviertel in 1987. Although I used to work by Anglo-Saxon standards, especially abroad, I became American in the new office. New managers came up with innovative ideas. The German titles were abolished. So suddenly, I was no longer a lead engineer but a senior estimator. Despite the uncertainties, and after some hesitation, my wife and I bought a row house in Bad Homburg-Oberesbach in 1988. We sold our apartment in Steinbach/TS. We shifted to our new house on January 13, 1989, which was a Friday. There was something positive on the office front too, the introduction of a data processing system, which was only smiled at or even rejected in the house. I was one of the first to work with the calculation system Multiplan because I gave magnificent work relief. In the wake of the oil trading business of the metal company, our company Lurgy also fell into a severe business crisis. This meant good engineers had to retire at 55. It was a real squandering of valuable resources. Along with this came the incomprehensible closure of good foundries in the then world leaders Germany. In their narrow-mindedness and inability, managers and politicians in Germany of the time made a miserable demonstration at the expense of workers and taxpayers. The mood in many companies and among the population in general was oppressive. Our company also had to work temporarily. I was lucky to keep my job. During that time, young people were recruited. One of them was the young Dr. Peter Weber. Often, he came to our office with hand-drawn sketches and asked for help with the calculation of the prices of his ideas. Many, and especially the older colleagues, had no time for him. So, it turned out that together with him, I often tried to create a rough profitability analysis. Finally, the management urged that every procedural engineer must explain his procedure with a lecture to interested employees. Dr. Weber occupied himself with enthusiasm to deliver his lecture with the Cerciard procedure. The subject captivated him strongly, and his shyness totally vanished before the assembled crew. Finally, I worked with him and American colleagues from Cliffs on an offer to build a Cerciard plant in Trinidad. The offer was accepted after many changes, the plant was built, and Dr. Weber flew to Trinidad for commissioning. The facility, which was essentially based on the theoretical principles of Dr. Weber, worked amazingly quickly and successfully, which I had never seen before in my steel works. Because of our miserable management, our company Lurgy Metallurgy was finally sold to the Finnish company Outokumpu. The business climate improved visibly and I had several occasions to fly to Helsinki for reasons of integration and Dr. Weber, who even temporarily lived with his family in Finland, eventually became the managing director of Outokumpu, now Autotech, Germany in Oberursel. This I read only after my retirement in the Tonnesitung. It was a venerable ceremony. Dr. Peter Weber, managing director of Autotech GmbH from Oberursel, was honored as a Knight of the White Rose at the Finnish Embassy in Berlin. The Finnish Order of the White Rose is the highest award of the Republic of Finland and is awarded by the President Tarja Karina Halonen for merit around the country. Other winners of the award are Carl XVI Gustav, King of Sweden, the German operator Konrad Mellerois, the German Commander-in-Chief of the Kriegsmarine, Erik Redder, and the artist Peter Gabrian, who painted the Mitternachtszone. And what did Weber do for the Nordic country? Under his leadership, new technologies have been developed to help ensure the sustainable use of the natural resources of our planet, said Pertti Korhonen, a member of the Finnish Autotech. Travel to Salt Lake City. My stay in Salt Lake City for a feasibility study is also worth a mention. Because of the competition, only an accurate calculation of the order would help us lead. After receiving an order, I found it important to convey to all the employees involved that the contract had only come to us due to the precise calculation. Here, the psychological component plays a very important role for success. I had this experience during one of my first projects, when I had said, due to my inexperience, order now, we still have enough money. This sentence cost us dearly. But in the case of Salt Lake City, I informed both the employees and our management about the importance of precise calculation. Almost instantaneous saving measures were taken for all those involved in the contract. For example, employees had to fly wood class. So, the person responsible for the calculation, too, had to fly wood class to Salt Lake City. At the Frankfurt AM airport, my fate took the following course. Since our travel department had failed to fix the return flight, the airline Delta required a visa for the USA. But I did not have an entry or work visa. So, I immediately applied for a visa-free entry as a tourist. The fee for this was 150 DM. However, during the order processing, it turned out that the customer had special wishes. So, the return flight had to be rescheduled several times. This cost again about 150 DM as the transfer fee. So, the cheap wood class ticket gradually became more expensive than a business ticket. All in all, however, this order was settled with profit, thanks to the motivation of all the employees. Despite the workload, there was also time for private enterprises, for example, trips to Park City to the Winter Olympics buildings still under construction, the Tanger Outlet Center Park, and the Salt Temple of the Mormons. I noticed that the Mormons worked diligently and drank little or no alcohol. I did not notice anything of the Mormon polygamy. Trip to Qatar. A short trip to Qatar in 1998 was very interesting for me. At first, we flew from Frankfurt to London. From there, we flew Qatar Airways to Doha. Immediately before the flight took off from London, we heard a prayer on the loudspeaker. I did not understand anything, but I felt that I was praying for a good flight. I was surprised when, after reaching the airport, The bar was opened immediately and everyone was given alcohol as they desired. We stayed at the Sheraton Hotel in Doha with our American colleagues from the company Midrex Technologies. There, too, one had only to go to the 8th floor to drink a beer, though Qatar was and still is a Muslim country. Millennium Bug. In 1997, my son joined the company Lehman Computer Service. Because of the uncertainty about the turn of the millennium, it was converted into a GmbH due to reasons of liability. According to Wikipedia, authoritative chaos fears played a significant role in 1999/2000, since complications with date changes in computer systems could not be ruled out, if programmers of important systems had provided only a two-digit date data, as it was usual in the memory-sparing early programming times, Millennium Bug. A feared collapse of global computer networks, however, did not materialize. Within his company, he had many, partly also well-known customers, e.g. the Frankfurt PR, the event agency Metro Press, and the family Herrhausen in Bad Homburg. Of course, everyone wanted to guarantee that the systems he supplied would also work in 2000. At the time, however, Microsoft did not give such a guarantee. But as my son fell ill with psychosis towards the end of his military service, my wife and I were very concerned. We looked for doctors and took all opportunity to help him. In the meantime, I took over the management of his company and worked in this constellation until we moved to Bad Kissingen in Autotech. My wife and I moved to Bad Kissingen in 2009. My son, however, told us a few months later that he wanted to come to Bad Kissingen. Thanks to the help of the doctors and our local acquaintances in the Run Club and Kegel Club, as well as his own efforts, he succeeded in recovering. Last trip to Kolkata. I went on my last mission to Calcutta to the company Larsen & Toubro in December 2006 with my colleague Ruffer. Larsen & Toubro is the largest construction and engineering company in India. We stayed at the Hyatt Regency for 2 nights. After the second day, our hosts recommended that we leave Calcutta prematurely due to an announced, imminent unrest between Hindus, Muslims, and other social groups. They feared the worst and said that we could not possibly understand what was going on. From my earlier trips to India, however, I knew that there was more violence among Hinduism, Muslims, and Christians in various places in India, which was hardly noticed in Europe. At any rate, we still escaped to the airport at night and then came back to Frankfurt safely with Lufthansa. Lives of my family members end. During a precautionary examination, I was diagnosed with skin cancer on the left cheek, probably a souvenir of my Australia stays. Who likes to think about illness, life, or death? The end of life is justly suppressed, for one wants to or must live and cannot always think of the end. You always say, good morning, good day, good evening, and good night, but a good end of life is not usual. My melanoma was surgically removed in 2008 and the facial scar healed well over the years. I felt well again, but the diagnosis of cancer encouraged me to think about the different deaths in my family circle. My father died of a stroke on July 8, 1985 at 87. My mother, sister, and I looked after him in his last days and nights. He could not speak anymore, but he could communicate with gestures. Although I was with my mother the next night, I missed the day of his death because of a professionally important appointment. I regret that very much today. My mother died shortly thereafter on September 18, 1988, at the age of 88. She died very quietly and peacefully with the whole family by her bedside. It was as if a candle had been snuffed out. She took leave of her life with a handshake with everyone present. It was a moving experience even for my then 10-year-old son. We received the news of the death of my lonely mother-in-law by telephone in April 1999. She lived alone, though my wife had arranged a beautiful apartment in a multi-generational house in Saarbrücken. She suddenly refused, without ever giving the reason. She was found in her bathtub several days after her death. The exact time and circumstances of her death remained unknown. Unfortunately, on May 20, 1999, only my wife and I were present at the urn burial. Her three other children stayed away. My sister died at 82 on January 17, 2006 in her house in Offenbach/Maine, in the presence of her husband and a Polish nurse. She had been suffering from Alzheimer's disease since her 80th year, and hid her illness until it became too obvious. She recognized my wife and me almost to her death, but was no longer able to express herself intelligibly. With the help of Alzheimer's counseling, we tried to provide her with a better quality of life as much as possible. Unfortunately, this failed because of the behavior of my brother-in-law, who probably did not understand the facilities on offer. In this case, a timely decision by my sister could have changed things to her advantage. Only about 2 weeks later, my brother-in-law, too, died of a sudden heart attack at the age of 86 on February 2, 2006, in his chair. Even his last will could not be executed due to the lack of a corresponding order. So, it turned out that a daughter of his sister, who was in the GDR with the Stasi and, therefore, could never be allowed a visit, inherited part of his property. According to the statements he had made during his lifetime, my brother-in-law would probably not have wanted that. However, these experiences showed that for a good life conclusion, it is also important to make a patient assignment as well as a precautionary allowance in good time. Life can end due to age, illness, accident, extraneous factors, or suicide. From the gentle falling asleep to a long, painful death, everything is possible, and we learn daily how different lives can be. New beginning in Bad Kissingen. In May 2009, we sold our house in Ober-Eschbach and moved to Nudlingen until the completion of our apartment. At the end of August 2009, we moved to our new apartment in Bad Kissingen. My wife, my son, and I became members of the Run Club Branch Association of Bad Kissingen. My wife and I went out on many walks together. Although we kept fit at the fitness arena of the Kiss Solace Therm, I soon started having problems during some day trips, initially because of back pain. While hiking in the Meiningen area on June 9, 2013, I fell and, as it turned out later, suffered a tendon rupture in my left shoulder. Although I had the shoulder treated for over a year at the advice of my then physician at Volterans Alba, the pain did not ease. Therefore, I sought the help of a specialist, who immediately made the right diagnosis and prescribed painkillers and physiotherapy. Since I was a member of the fitness arena of the Kiss Solace, I also tried to find a corresponding therapist here. So, I met Anja Kirchner, who is a hard-working, talented, and very popular physiotherapist in Kiss Solace. Anja not only successfully treated my shoulder but also taught me exercises. Both of these resulted in the fact that I was finally free of pain in the shoulder within a short time. In October 2014, we hiked with the Run Club in Marin Country. Even there, I could only take the lightest day trips and, on some days, none. In March 2015, as my physical condition deteriorated, I went to the neurological clinic in Bad Neustadt at the insistence of my physician. To my great surprise, I was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. I was rather skeptical about the diagnosis because, in my opinion, I did not have any other symptom except for problems of balance and a slightly slurred speech. On the contrary, according to the doctors, the results of the numerous examinations were very good. Even then, I was on regular physiotherapy to improve my balance. For a few weeks, I ran very badly and got quickly exhausted. Since Anja had treated me so successfully with my shoulder problem, I sought her help. However, my wife, my son, and I realized that there would be only an improvement in agility but no healing. They gave me great confidence and Anja said, "We'll get the balance again. With the right medicines, you will get better and even fly back to Australia." Nevertheless, she also advised me to seek rehabilitation at the Klinik Bavaria, which she knew well from earlier times. After my health insurance cleared the expenses, I went to the Klinik Bavaria in Bad Kissingen from October 30, 2015 to November 25, 2015. The doctors and therapists there were open-minded and competent. I took the medicines and all the therapies unfailingly in the hope of improving my stability and balance. However, I was trying too hard. I wanted to give a better picture of myself to my wife, my son, and Anja, and I paid for my overexertion with two falls, which affected me mentally. So, I had to start with Anja's physiotherapy all over again. During a back massage, when I lay on my stomach, I said to her, "Anja, but I cannot see your smile." She answered, "But it is there. She has a charisma." After physiotherapy on December 23, 2015, we wished each other Merry Christmas and a healthy and good year 2016, and embraced. After that, I did not find the remaining days in 2015 so good. I had to fight the illness, which is why we had to cancel the New Year's Eve program at the old opera house in Frankfurt. The weather was gray and rainy. My wife advised me to write down the course of my complaints because my body was probably trying to tell me something, which I had not always listened to with the necessary care. At first, my body gradually moved to the left while walking. I rushed down the hill, had no strength to get up, and was just exhausted. Even during a normal hike, I felt increasingly bad. Furthermore, there was in speech problems and gait uncertainties. Especially while putting up with harsh weather conditions, my problems intensified. Braveheart Anja. When I learned that Anja was training for the Braveheart battle in Biskopsheim/Ron, December 3, 2016,
Hello, I felt better
and was very motivated.
Many thanks for your interest in my welfare after the Braveheart battle in Biskopsheim on December 3, 2016. Due to the high demand, I decided to write a detailed report about my Nadederlebnis. You have certainly read a lot in the newspaper and seen on television. The Braveheart battle has 32 kilometers, about 50 obstacles, 1,200 meters, a lot of freezing water and icy temperatures, which brought many participants to their limits. Most people who know me know that I do a lot of sports. I was already present at the triathlon, semi-marathon, and the Braveheart battle in Münnerstadt, but this Braveheart battle in Biskopsheim brought me to my limits. My biggest fear was the weather. I hoped for sun and no wind, but the opposite happened. Before the start, we even saw a few single snowflakes. By the crowds kept us warm, and the funny conversations with other participants made the wait until the start tolerable. Together with Philip and Matza, also from the Kiss Solace, I started at 11.30 in the fifth starting block. At the beginning, the two gentlemen started overmotivated, but I caught up with them quickly on the mountains of the ski jumping hill, and then we mastered the rest together. Each of us had a weak phase and was driven back by the others. So, we made it together after 5.30 hours to the finish. I can proudly say that I came in as the 26th woman out of 203 to the finish. We took most of the time, of course, in Biskopsheim. It had the most spectators and the most obstacles, the cold Brend crawl, meter-deep mudholes, stormy periods, running against snow cannons, etc. But the worst and most exhausting part came after that. Only after running about 13 kilometers through the muddiest of terrains and already powerless, with the mountains of the Rhône to overcome, I had to think about it, and I had to put my family members in the right places with warm tea, chocolate, bananas, etc. This helped us a lot to get the last piece out of the way. Of course, a few other runners came to the same place, and we shared the food. This was the most beautiful part. This community feeling, no competition, and everyone helping everyone. Above all, as a woman, you did not have to exert yourself with so many obstacles. Several men were pushed around. Gladly, I think, there for example back to the mud holes, where I flew out. When we came to the finish even under the 6 hours we were incredibly relieved, glad, and happy. It was an indescribable feeling to have done such a thing. I have seen so many people suffer. Crying women, trembling men, and many who lay side by side with strong spasms. You surely think, why are you doing something like that? They are all completely crazy. You are right. And we stand by. You want to prove yourself to yourself, just make something crazy, and when you get the respect of others, it is even more beautiful. How was it after that? On the competition day, all was quite well, except that I was a bit tired but managed. The next day, I had some problems in my big toe joint and pain, which I had to handle with kinesio taping. Later came the first signs of sore muscles. So, I went to the sauna in the afternoon. In the evening, I treated my legs with horse balsam and, on Monday, I did not feel anything of the hardships of Saturday. Surprisingly, I felt even better than I do after a half marathon, when I am only 1.50 hours on the road. So, how did I prepare? Regular saunas, cold showers to cure, regular running training, even over the floor and stones, and up the mountains. I'm simply a hard nut with good defenses.
Epilogue.
Would I do that again?
It is still my goal to stabilize my health. Even these lines should contribute to this. No doctor must be blamed. It is clear to me that a mistake can be made and time is often very short. Also, the doctor portal JAMDA is to be used with caution because it is not objective. But the documented behavior of some doctors has made me very thoughtful and shattered my original confidence. 1. My shoulder pain, which lasted for more than a year, could not be healed by my house physician. It was only the correct diagnosis of a tendon rupture by Dr. Doring and his recommendation to do physiotherapy that did heal my pain. Fortunately, I got to the therapist Anja Kirchner, who made me painless in a brief time. 2. A neurologist made a rash diagnosis of Parkinson's without any investigation. 3. This diagnosis was discarded not only by the doctors of a neurological clinic, but also after the DTSCAN. 4. According to the DTSCAN, there was no evidence of Parkinson's disease. 5. Although a physician also doubted the diagnosis of Parkinson's disease, he believed my age was the cause of the complaints. However, I did not feel that way and did not want to leave anything untried. Therefore, after being diagnosed with prostate carcinoma, I again got myself examined by a urologist at the University Hospital in Würzburg. From the preliminary assessment, I have understood that currently my immune system combats the cancer cells present in the body and, thereby, also triggers the complaints. To eliminate my deficits, I initially decided to get an irradiation at the Leopoldina Hospital in Schweinfurt. After all the examinations and experiences, I am convinced once more that the unconditional will to become healthier is the right recipe for improvement.